My name is Charlie Mays. I'm a pastor in Renton, Washington, whose claim to fame is that's where Boeing makes everything except the 747 and the coming 767. We also make a lot of railroad cars and other such things. And this week, from now through Saturday, we are going to be looking at the Gospel of Luke. And one of the things that Larry asked me to do is if I could somehow or another come up with a capitalization of what I was going to say each day. I have no idea what I'm going to say each day, let alone capitalize it. So what we will do is simply launch into this and then see where we get, and then we'll announce the theme for the next day. There are two reasons, I think, for this. The first reason is that I would like to have the study be somewhat participatory so that we deal somewhat with the kinds of things you would like to know, and so that you can have some ownership of the way we progress, if that's what we, or move, maybe it'd be a better word rather than progress. And the other thing is that I guess I'm undisciplined enough so that to sit down and to write out all of my lectures just would simply be something I'm incapable of doing. The Gospel of Luke was chosen because I'm going to be developing the thesis that the Gospel of Luke probably has more resources for us in the American church as we face the 1980s. It has more resources than the other three Gospels. I think Luke deals with issues more akin to the situation in which we find ourselves than do the other three Gospels. And so that's why we've chosen to look at Luke's Gospel. Also, as a kind of way to be cute, I guess, and to pique somebody's curiosity, we've entitled the course together, How to Prosper in the Coming Hard Times. There's a book, I guess, by a guy by the name of Ruff that has roughly the same title. And so this is a takeoff on that, and I think that we're going to find that Luke's answer is a little bit different, nuances of difference at least, from Ruff's answer about how one should prosper in the coming hard times. We're making some assumptions even in that title that we are in a period of transition, and they probably will be rough times, hard times, different times at least. One other word about methodology. Please, if there's something that, I shouldn't say if there's something that is unclear, there may be a whole lot of stuff that's unclear. If it gets too bad, raise your hand and somehow or another get my attention and stop me. I tell the people in my congregation that, and they know this, they now know that they'd better get in right away or there's no getting in at all. Because once my brain goes into neutral and my mouth into high, we're done. So you've got to, you've got to watch that. Some people in this room have been with me in other kinds of classes, and so they know that. So they can verify that. What I want to do, I want to structure this so that those of you who are here only for today, or maybe only for part of the week, will be able to take something away that is of value, and that even though we're going to be working through the Gospel of Luke, you will have each one will stand on its own, more or less, each session. Now, Luke, it seems to me, deals with some themes that are relevant to our time, and I want to just mention those today. I also want to mention what I see as the roots of Luke and the context in which we find Luke's gospel. So we're going to spend most of our time really in introduction to Luke's gospel. Now, I've never been a fan of Luke's gospel. I just was never very interested in it. I remember when I was in seminary, I taught a class in a little church in St. Paul. And we had, it was a junior high school class, and we were using an old ALC curriculum that was called That You May Know. And it was, it even had the kids count the number of verses in Luke's gospel so that they would find out that Luke's gospel was the longest one. Well, we'd gone a couple Sundays, and this one little smart-aleck kid said, "What are we doing this for? This is boring." And he was right. And so and so we read through Luke's gospel, and the kids kind of enjoyed it. That should have been a clue to me that maybe there was something there, but I didn't catch the clue. And then I've been working on a doctor of ministry degree towards trying to develop a theology of enough for suburbia. And in looking around for biblical resources, who should turn up but Luke? That was a surprise to me. And then when Larry asked me to come up and teach, I thought, well, I'm going to spend some time immersed in Luke's gospel. And then I came to the conclusion, and this is the thesis we're going to test out, is that Luke's gospel really has more resources to offer us, perhaps, as we face the 80s in America than any of the other three gospels. Now, that's a broad statement, but I want to test that out. Luke deals with themes such as the use of wealth. And I think that's a theme that we need to deal with as an American church. And so we're going to be looking at what Luke says about wealth. There's some debate about whether Luke's gospel is a gospel written to the poor or whether it's a gospel written to the rich. If it's a gospel written for the rich, he probably got into his ministry 3 weeks and they showed him the door. But if he's writing to the poor, then why does he demand from the rich what he demands? It's an interesting question, but I think it's one that we need to look at. And Luke suggests, kind of has three themes, I think, in dealing with wealth, and we'll talk about those as they appear in the gospel. And he's the one who says, sell all that you have. It's interesting. When you compare him to what the other Gospels say about possessions, he always adds a little Greek word, punta, everything. When the disciples in Luke's Gospel leave in order to follow Jesus, they leave punta, everything. No messing around in Luke's Gospel. When Jesus visits with the man that needs one thing, he's to leave punta, everything, and follow Jesus. And then he has some words, particularly we're going to spend some time on Zacchaeus, who is a model for the use of wealth in Luke Acts. Okay, so Luke deals with the theme of possessions. Then another theme, of course, that Luke deals with is the theme of nationality. And of religiosity, if you will, of kind of exclusive religion, exclusive ethnic identity, exclusive nationalism. Luke deals with what it means to be in the people of God, which is inclusive and not exclusive in Luke's understanding. Another theme that Luke deals with, of course, is the place of women, which I think as we in the Lutheran Church face what it means to have ordained women among us will be important. One of the first women in Luke's gospel that is healed is called a daughter of Abraham. And then later on when we come to Zacchaeus, who stands as a watershed text in many ways in Luke, he is called a son of Abraham. But this woman occurs in Luke 7 is already called a daughter of Abraham. So there's a whole theme of women. That's been well known for a long time, that Luke had that kind of concern, and we're going to be examining it. So Luke presents us, I think, and we'll look basically at those three themes in order to limit ourselves during the week, namely of the use of possessions or wealth, what Luke says about that. We'll be looking at what he says about exclusive religion and nationality, and then the role of the role of women. Also, we're going to be considering the fact that Luke is the most unspiritual of the Gospels. He de-spiritualizes what the faith means. And I'll just throw that out, and I'm not going to talk about that right now. But I think we'll discover that Luke has a real concern about what happens in the world. You see, Hal Lindsey wasn't the first guy that came down the pike and talked about, in essence, escaping the world. And so Luke is going to be drawing our attention that the faith is lived out in this world, and that pie in the sky and all of that is a detraction from life in this world. And so he's going to be dealing something with what the end times mean. He de-spiritualizes, de-eschatologizes in one sense, in terms of pushing what the Christian faith means clear out into the future and into what all that matters is what happens to my soul after I die. Luke is going to be dealing with that question over and over again. In fact, if any of you who are pastors are and know Danker's book, Jesus in the New Age, or the Proclamation series on Luke, he really pushes that theme, perhaps too much, but I think the theme is there nonetheless. Okay, those are just some general kinds of things, and we'll be bringing in some others as we move through. I want to talk for just a minute or two about Luke's place in the New Testament, dealing with authorship a little bit, not very much, because authorship of books usually bores me. And because the interesting thing is that none of the Gospels have their names signed to them. The important thing is that to which they point. And so the authorship is very difficult. Luke's authorship, or that it was attributed to Luke, is something that happened early in the church. It grows out of the we passages in Acts. And if you read through Acts, the we passages, in my estimation, don't straighten the authorship out a whole lot. They simply are confusing, because right in the middle, in essence, of a sentence, Luke moves from they to we, or whoever this we was. And so authorship isn't, to me, terribly important. Also, it has not its importance, because it seems to me that we need to understand that each of the Gospels grow out of a community of faith, that the community of faith is far more significant than the person that penned the material. And Luke gives, I think, a reflection of a community, and that's, for me, terribly important. The date of Luke's gospel is in dispute, and the dates run all the way from sometime prior to A.D. 63, and the reason for that is that when Luke ends his two volumes, Paul is still alive and kicking in Rome. And that if Paul, who is such, the argument runs that if Paul is such a important person in Luke's two-volume work, taking up the last half of the last volume, then he surely would have reported his death had he known it. Well, it seems to me that argument is not sustainable in very, very many ways, some of which I'll show you in a moment. Another argument is that it had to be written sometime prior to 70 AD, which is the fall of Jerusalem, because Luke does not record directly the fall of Jerusalem. I reject that also. I think the material that deals with the fall of Jerusalem is sufficiently explicit to tell us that Luke knew of the historical details of the fall of Jerusalem. And then someplace the writing of Luke's gospel way into the 90s. I think that's, or 93 or so AD, I think that's too late. I would argue for an authorship, or a date of authorship, of Luke's gospel sometime after the year 79 AD. And I would argue for that on some internal evidence, not only from the book of Luke, but also from the book of Acts. Not too many Sundays ago, we read Pentecost text on May the 25th, which for those of us who live in some proximity to St. Helens had all three texts that day, had, you know, including the Old Testament text, had something about, or the Psalm talked about smoking mountains. That was an interesting day. But if you look in the book of Acts at the Pentecost story, and you look at the quotation from Joel, I think you have to ask yourself, why did Luke include what he did from Joel? And just let me share this with you shortly. You know the story when Peter gets up to explain what was going on in Pentecost, and I'll pick up at the 17th verse where he says, this was spoken by the prophet Joel. "And in the last days it shall be, God declares, that I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, and your young men shall see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams. Yea, and on my maidservants, or on my men servants and my maidservants, in those days I will pour out my spirit, and they shall prophesy." That should have been as far as he needed to go to recount what happened on Pentecost, right? Because that's what happened. But notice what he includes. "And I will show wonders in the heavens above and signs on the earth beneath, blood and fire and vapor of smoke. The sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the day of the Lord comes, the great and manifest day. And it shall be that whoever calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved." 79 AD, Vesuvius erupted. George Caird, in his book, The Theology The Revelation of St. John the Divine, which is a commentary in the Harper commentary series on the book of Revelation, has a listing of the kinds of events that had already happened by the time the book of Revelation was written. And one of when I first read that, I could not understand why the eruption of Vesuvius was such a heavy image. And then when St. Helens went off, it dawned on me, that baby darkened the Mediterranean basin. It caused tidal waves. One of the end time signs was those kind of cataclysmic catastrophes. Luke is trying to say, I think, something about the entrance into end time. He's dealing with eschatology. What do we make of these babbling folks is one thing. What do we make of these cosmic signs is another thing. So that's why I think Luke was written after 79. Also, if you go back into the 21st chapter of Luke's gospel, and you'll notice material that's listed about what's going to happen in the last days. And this is a happy hunting ground for Billy Graham and Hal Lindsey and all those folks. I tell my people at home I know more than they do, and they say, well, how come they preach to millions and and we're stuck with you? And then I remind them that Luke talks about little flocks and all that. But anyway, if you look at the material in Luke 21, these are virtually all events that by the time Luke writes are past events, or maybe a better way to say it, are present events, and remain present events to this day. Just some samplings. Verse 10. "Then he said to them, nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be great earthquakes and in various places famines and pestilences, and there will be terrors and great signs from heaven. But before all this, they will lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and prisons, and you will be brought before kings and governors for my name's sake." That's a travelogue for Paul's activities in Acts, right? Then, interestingly, verse 13, which in the RSV is translated, this will be a time for you to bear testimony. New International Version has a better translation of that text, and because it's much more accurate and in keeping with the Greek, it says, this will result in your being witnesses to them. In other words, when all hell is breaking loose, what is the role of the church? To begin looking at our belly buttons and find a map to the future? No, it's to give proclamation in this situation. Proclamation to what? To the kingdom which is coming in Jesus Christ, which has come and is coming in this one whom God has sent. And then the rest of this you can look through in terms of those kind of events. Now, in order to shorthand this kind of thing, I'll just read a quotation from C.B. Caird's or G.B. Caird's book on Revelation. And I'll just pick it up in the time frames. The first paragraph or the first sentence you have to translate into Revelation, but then it'll come clear because the specific dates are given. During the last 35 years of his life, John has lived through a series of grim events which might well seem a challenge to Christian belief in the kingship of Christ. First, the earthquakes of A.D. 60. Second, the humiliating defeat of the Roman army on the eastern frontier by the Parthians in A.D. 62. Three, the persecution of the Christians which followed the fire of Rome in A.D. 64. Four, the four-year horror of the Jewish war, which ended in A.D. 70 with Jerusalem in ruins. And then five, the suicide of Nero in A.D. 68, and the political chaos which ensued as four claimants battled for the imperial throne. And seven, for a whole year, the Roman world echoed to the tramp of marching armies. And then finally, the eruption of Vesuvius in A.D. 79, which had obliterated the luxury resorts of the Bay of Naples and created a pall of darkness so widespread that men feared the imminent dissolution of the physical order. My brother lives in Pullman, and they were over recently, and my wife asked my sister-in-law, what did it feel like? And she said, when they went to bed, the only thing they hoped for is that there would be light in the morning. The utter eeriness of it turning dark in the midst of day. Okay, so I think those images then and those pictures begin to give us some indication of what Luke is dealing with, as well as the purpose that I set out to establish, that I think Luke's gospel is written sometime after 79 AD, and it deals with historical present events which continue to this day, just changed the cast of characters. What does it mean to be the people of God in the midst of this situation? That's what Luke, part of what Luke is dealing with. Okay, having settled beyond any reasonable doubt the authorship of, or the date of Luke, authorship, I have not the foggiest about who this turkey was. People that read Greek well enough tell me, and through books, that Luke is the finest of the Greek writers. I can read the stuff halfway, but I'm so jerky at reading, I can't tell that he's any less jerky than Mark, which they tell me Mark is really a jerky as far as it goes in spurts, writing the Greek. But Luke, probably the author, certainly has some sensitivities for the Greek people. Now, I'm gonna do a little kind of a parenthesis for a minute, because I want to show you the relationship of the Gospels. Over on that wall, I've placed a chart that to me is that's better than popcorn and as good as a chocolate fudge sundae, but that's a diagram of the synoptic relationships, and so that you'll understand what we mean by synoptic. Those of us that deal with the New Testament seminary or had to, the synoptics is a shorthand way of talking about Matthew, Mark, and Luke. The word synoptic comes from the Greek meaning to see together or see roughly in the same way, seeing like in synthetic and optic like in to see. And the thesis is that that Matthew, Mark, and Luke look at the life of Jesus in roughly the same way. They follow roughly the same pattern in looking at the life of Jesus. John goes off in a very different direction. Some people see Luke as a bridge to John, and there are a lot of similarities that we'll talk about as we go through the week. Now, in 1938, some Englishman did us a great service. He went through and on the basis of Hook's synopsis of the Greek Testament, put together that chart, and then he translated it into the English Bible so that each inch of those charts represents 32 verses. He counted the number of verses, and he looked at where the verbal structures are the same and all of that kind of stuff. And then he put together those codes. The Mark is the prior gospel. That's almost universally accepted in biblical scholarship, that Mark wrote first. And I'll get into, I'll show you the reasons why they think that, and I think they're fairly conclusive. Mark is obviously the shortest gospel. Matthew and Luke came along, and they changed some things about Mark. The interesting thing is that they never changed the same thing in the same way. In other words, if Mark says something, Luke may disagree with him as to order, but then Matthew will agree with him. The way that we say that is that Matthew and Luke never agree together against Mark. Okay? Now, I'm going to show you in another chart form a little bit simpler way to look at this, and then you can make some, you can come up here and you can study that, and I bring charts like that home to my wife, and she says, huh? I mean, what's the big deal about that? But I think that's just... And in 1976, they upgraded that on the basis of the different texts and things that were being used. For our purposes, we'll look... Mark was written probably sometime of the year 65 to 70. That's fairly, I think, the accepted date. And Mark has 669 verses. He has 669 verses. Now, Matthew has 1,049 verses, 69 verses. Of the 669 verses that Mark has, Matthew has 609 of those verses. And you'll notice that there's a whole lot of red or pink or whatever that color is in Matthew. He writes those, he shorthands Mark a little bit, and he can do all of that in 523 verses. It's interesting, when you look at the miracle stories in Mark compared to the miracle stories in Matthew, Matthew always shortens the miracle stories. He turns them into dialogue and so that Jesus visits with the person that he's healing and makes them much shorter. He also always makes the miracles much greater. And he does it by interesting little devices. Now, when I say always, I don't always mean always, but usually. Okay? But like on the feeding miracles, where Mark will say he fed 5,000 men or 4,000 men, Matthew is able, in just a phrase, to triple the result, at least triple the result. How does he do that? And women and children. He always heightens the miraculous in Mark, but he always shortens him too, so you can see how he cuts him down. Matthew also has, if you look on the over there, there's a bunch of white stuff. That's unique Matthew material, which is called Special Matthew by the scholars. And that's 282 verses of his own, plus 93 that are called mixed. He's borrowed from Matthew or Mark in some way, not quite strictly. So he has a good bunch of material that is uniquely his own. Now, Luke, who we're concerned with, is the longest gospel. He has 1,150 verses. But he doesn't use as many verses from Matthew, rather, or from Mark, rather, he copies 357, and then he has rough parallels in another 95 verses. Now, he's also able to shorten Mark in that he can get those 357 verses into 325. Luke does not tell us the story of the feeding of the 4,000. He gives us only one feeding story, and then he goes on to other things. It's called, in biblical terms, the great omission. He just omits a whole ton of material from the first feeding miracle until the confession at Caesarea Philippi. He leaves out that material. I think omission is the wrong word. He substitutes. He uses other stuff. Journey to the getting ready for some activity in Jerusalem. But that's, we'll get into that too. All right. Now, Luke also has some special stuff. All this yellow stuff on this chart. He got a whole bunch of that. That's called creatively special Luke. 491 of his own verses. 491. And he has 173 that are mixed, that have parallels or some relationship with Mark or with Matthew. But they're not close enough to say definitely they come from those. Just like now, if you were to do a whole bunch of math, the thing that you would find out is that there are some additional verses left. Biblical scholarship has posited the existence of a source, another writing source, which they call Quelle in the German, which simply means a source. Now, there are 151 verses that Matthew and Luke share together. There are an additional 94 that are very, very close. So they think they came from the same source. So they call that Q. These are mainly the teachings of Jesus. In Matthew, it's the Sermon on the Mount. In Luke, it's the Sermon on the Plain. Okay, see, for theological reasons and Christological reasons, Matthew has Jesus go up on the mountain. Luke has Jesus stay down on the plain. Teach the same thing, but they do it in different places. And there's a reason for that, I think. And we'll try to show that. My hope is that when I say we'll try to show these things, you'll forget what it is I said I was going to show you, okay? Because I won't remember some of it. All right. Now that just places Luke within the New Testament, particularly with the gospel stories. There are some other contexts that I think are terribly important for us to understand about Luke's gospel. One of the things in the description that I gave Larry to read this morning, I said that whatever the New Testament, and I think this is particularly and peculiarly true for Luke, whatever Luke says about Christ is rooted in what the Hebrew Bible says about God. If Jesus is Savior, it's because the Old Testament knows God as Savior. If they say something about the gracious activity of Jesus Christ, it's because the Old Testament knows the gracious activity of God. I'm going to have another little digression here for a moment. The Christian church needs to rediscover the Hebrew Bible, what we call the Old Testament. And I think that we need even to find a different way of talking about it. Maybe we could call it the First Testament or the Earliest Testament or something, because we have become Marcionites in the sense that we have cut ourselves off from that great body of material, which is the heart and core of our faith. And so I'm going to talk, that'll be the last thing I'm going to deal with this morning, about the Old Testament rootage of the Gospels. I'll just throw this out for one second. I believe that the reason that Luke is concerned about the poor, about women, about even religion and national exclusiveness is because he knows the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible. That's my thesis. That he has this driving urge to overcome all these barriers, to give witness to this one who brought the kingdom which overcomes these barriers, because he's rooted in the Old Testament. Now, being rooted in the Old Testament, he spoke in what I threw out as a cute way of saying it, Greco-Roman accents. Part of our problem, I don't know how many of you, when I was a pastor in Washington, D.C. and read the Washington Post, and of course, I left Washington, D.C. on the 11th of August, which is not terribly significant until you realize that Richard Nixon left on the 9th. In 1974. I'm not sure which of us left because the other one did, but anyway. What? Right, yeah. And he went out on Air Force One, and I went out on a Volkswagen, and a. But anyway, and the Washington Post did not observe my leaving. But anyway, Art Buchwald, who the Seattle Times doesn't pick up all the time, but. And now, of course, Doonesbury, our political commentators of the first rank. But the thing is that 50 years from now, if I should live so long, or even 40 years or 30 years, and if that should come to pass, I have grandchildren, and I can haul out, you know, if I were saving Doonesbury or Buchwald, I would have to help the children understand why that's so funny. Because without Richard Nixon and all the historical things that were happening, Art Buchwald wouldn't be nearly so funny. I don't think he would be funny at all unless one knows what it is that he's doing this satire on. Because we don't know the ancient world, we don't understand a lot of the stuff that's going on in the Bible. Revelation is the prime example of this for me. Two things that make it hard for us to understand Revelation. The first is we don't know the Old Testament. That's the first big problem. So that the allusions and the imagery that's being drawn out of the Old Testament just goes right on past us. And we don't know the contemporary situation. That's why I tried to illustrate by what Caird said about the historical events. The same thing is true in Luke. Now, there are some mythologies, some very common ways of understanding things that were common in the Greco-Roman world, in the Greek-Roman world of the time that the Gospels were written, that become important for the way in which the New Testament speaks. And here I'm going to be reading from material from interpretation. I think that if you could only get one magazine, if you're a pastor, and maybe if you get two, if you're a layperson and really into Bible stuff, the journal to get is Interpretation. I absolutely believe if you're interested in serious biblical scholarship, this is the journal to have. Since I don't read German or anything, I don't know what's available there. But in the October 1976 issue, Charles Talbert, who's an associate professor of religion at Wake Forest, wrote an article called Sifting Sands, The Recent Study of the Gospel of Luke. And he talks about the way Luke shows us Jesus. And let me just read a rather long thing, and I hope I can read it in a half-interesting way so the coffee will not have worn off yet. You'll still be awake at the end. Research since Conzelmann, and I haven't talked about Conzelmann. Hans Conzelmann was a German theologian that wrote a book on Luke's gospel, which the title in English is The Theology of St. Luke. The German title translates roughly The Middle Time. Everybody repudiates Conzelmann, but there isn't a book that you read about Luke that doesn't deal with Conzelmann. He was totally wrong, but you have to deal with him. That's what everybody says. Research since Conzelmann is divided over exactly how one goes about discerning Luke and Christology. Does one concentrate on the titles used for Jesus, or does one look for the overall structure of the Lucan picture of Jesus? In other words, you go in there and you'll notice that Luke calls Jesus the Son of David, the Son of God, the Son of Man, all of these titles. Is that how you find out what he's saying about Jesus? Or do you look at more at the whole overall picture? The difference such an approach can make is remarkable. If, for example, one focuses on the title Lord and notes that in the use of this title, Luke makes no distinction between the historical and the exalted Christ, one may be led to conclude that for Luke, there is no distinction between the earthly and exalted Lord. If, however, one looks at the overall pattern of Jesus' career in Luke Acts and notes that it conforms almost exactly to the myth of the immortals in Greco-Roman antiquity, one may be led to conclude that for Luke, the ascension marks a radical change in the status of Jesus. In Acts 3:21, there's a strange description of Jesus, the one whom heaven must receive until the end of time. Tell me what that means, and you won't have to come the rest of the week, because I haven't the foggiest what that means. But based on some Greek understandings, okay. Now, a more precise formulation of the shape of Lucan Christology has resulted from two contributions from the Greco-Roman background of the two-volume work. That's Luke Acts. On the one hand, the Lucan Jesus has been related to the mythology of immortals. In Mediterranean antiquity, near the beginning of our era, a distinction was made between two types of divine beings, eternals like Zeus, and immortals like Dionysius or Hercules. The immortals had originally been mortal, but at the end of their careers there occurred a transformation or ascension so that they obtained the same honors as the eternals. Some evidence of the ascent was usually given. Either an immortal's ascent to heaven was witnessed, or there was no trace of his physical remains. That the absence of the hero's physical remains pointed properly to an ascent to heaven was known from A, predictions or oracles during the hero's lifetime that he would be taken up, and B, a heavenly announcement at the end of his career stating or implying that he had been taken up, and C, appearances of the hero to friends or disciples confirming his new status. In addition, another feature frequently present in the description of the immortals was a reference to the man's being begotten by a god of a human mother, or his being a child of a goddess or a human father. When one spoke of an immortal in the Greco-Roman world, therefore, he meant a mortal who became a god, and this was expressed in terms of an extraordinary birth and an ascension into heaven. The other side of his deification, the immortal could and did intervene on behalf of his favorites. Now, this conclusion. Given the Lucan portrayal of Jesus, there is no way a Mediterranean person could have missed this as a portrayal of Jesus in the mythology of the immortals. In other words, the way Luke put his gospel together, he has the birth stories, the ascension stories. Look at Mark, has neither. John has implications about an ascension, but not the same thing. No birth stories. Matthew has birth stories and ascension stories. Okay, I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. That I will talk about, because that I'm not going to leave hanging. On the other hand, now we aren't done yet with the Greco-Roman folks. On the other hand, the Lucan Jesus has been related to the Greco-Roman image of a wandering philosopher. Though fluid, this image frequently contained the following elements. A, the philosopher was pictured as a wandering preacher whose journeys were sometimes the result of a divine command. B, the philosophy he expounded was a way of living rather than an explanation of life. C, his philosophy was learned by imitation of his lifestyle
as much or more than by remembering his precepts, a learning procedure he consciously cultivated. And D, in the controversy over the true and false philosopher, succession lists and narratives often function to designate where the living voice could be found, that is, where the way of life was lived as well as expounded. Again, a Mediterranean person looking at Luke Acts as a whole would have difficulty avoiding the impression that Jesus was a philosopher figure who founded the community which succeeded him. It is significant, moreover, that in antiquity, lives of philosophers were sometimes told in the myth of the immortals. Taken together, these two concepts furnish the best means for understanding the Lucan Jesus. Okay, now, what I'm going to propose is that what Luke has done is that he has taken the material that was at hand and he hammered it into a form that would communicate to his age.
The content is significantly different, but the form, the genre of the text itself, the shape it takes, would have flagged for the people in his world, aha, this is something special about this person. But the content is thoroughly Hebrew Bible. Luke has anchored the story of Jesus so deeply in the roots of the Old Testament people of God that it's just amazing to me. You know, we always thought, well, you know, Matthew was the guy that did that because he has all these, this happened to fulfill what was written by the prophet so-and-so, and then he quotes it. Matthew, when they gave that class in seminary and Luke and Matthew were there about how to use the Hebrew Bible, Matthew was asleep. Luke got the message. Now, if you can only read one book in the next 10 years, this is the book to read. Klaus Westermann, What Does the Old Testament Say About God? And the reason you may only want to read one in the next 10 years is that this book, which is 107 pages long, costs $8. The Presbyterians ripped us off. It's John Knox Press. That's I don't understand why a book like this cost. Well, from content, it's worth $80. It's incredible. I have one book that those of us who are ALC folks were at Victoria and heard Walter Bergman. He said one of the books to read is Gottwald's The Tribes of Israel. So I didn't bother to ask how many pages it had or what kind of book it was. And so I called Jennings Morgenthau at Luther Seminary Bookstore and I said, send me one. And he did. And it cost $14 with the discount. It's $20 paperback. But it's about 7,000 or 8,000 or 9,000 pages long. I've got it on my coffee table to impress people with the price on it. Not in the way in which we usually use the word myth. I'm really sorry that we've had, you know, that the word myth has fallen on hard times. Because for us, when we say that something is patently untrue, we say, well, that's a myth. Well, that's not the technical meaning of myth. Myth, in essence, means a story which is so true that it, in essence, is always true. Now, we would say that the truth of the story of Jesus obviously has historical foundation and therefore is true. Well, there's a whole lot of things about my life that are true. I was born over in eastern Washington and got cow manure in my shoes and the whole thing. That's all true and means nothing. Who cares? The significance of the birth of Jesus, whether it's exactly the way it is historically, that's that's the manure on the shoes. What it means, that's the universal truth, and I have no argument with that. I think the biblical writers were, in essence, getting at the myth of the thing in the sense of that which is always true, which is true beyond its time and place. And what I'm saying, and I'm glad for the question, don't think that what Talbert has said here is that Luke just willy-nilly made up this stuff. But what he did is that he took the form of the story of the immortals and the wandering philosophers and said, you know, if I cast, I don't know if he said this, but let's imagine that he did. He said, if I cast the story of Jesus in this form, when the folks hear it, who don't have any familiarity with the Hebrew Bible, the Hebrew tradition, they'll say, important person, I better listen to the story. Gordy Lathrop has a tape in the resource series, and I can't remember the date now, but it's on the Lucan birth narratives. If any of you are pastors or you're ALC pastors that get resource cassette, a few years back, Gordy has a beautiful working out of this thing by talking about the birth of Diogenes, and his mother went out into the fields. She'd been impregnated by a god, and she was to give birth to this god. And when she was out in the field, she got frightened and gave birth, and then there were swans there, and these swans started to dance around, and the whole form of that story is very similar to the singing angels in the Lucan narrative. Changes the content because there's thoroughly biblical content to it, but the genre is something that would communicate to the Greco-Roman world. Now, Vesterman, to get into that Old Testament stuff, Vesterman says we don't read our Old Testament very well, and that the Old Testament is carrying on, and this is gross simplification and overgeneralization, but that's because I'm not very sharp, and that's the only way I can say it. But he says there are two traditions in the Old Testament. There is a redemption tradition and a creation tradition. The creation tradition didn't stop with the Exodus. But there is a whole picture of God as gracious sustainer, whose good gifts, whose rain falls on the just and the unjust alike, and whose crap falls on the just and the unjust alike too. And then there's a picture of his peculiar relationship with a people wherein he is redeemer. But it's never limited to just those folks. Now, I want to just go through Vesterman's little book and read some phrases out of it, and you can make some connections with Luke yourself, and we'll be making them later on. He said, he's now talking about blessing, and this book in terms of talking about blessing, Vesterman often appears in interpretation, and one of the areas in which he's done a lot of work is with the Psalms of Lamentation, where people complain to God. You know, some of our, I haven't gone through LBW to find out how many of the laments made it, but in a lot of Christian hymnals, they left them out. Doug Hall, who wrote Light in Our Darkness and the Reality of the Gospel and the Unreality of the Churches, and has a new book now called Has the Church a Future? I heard him say one time that one of the reasons that Christian worship is so unreal is we have no time for complaint. It's like your charismatic friends always just want to praise the Lord, in spite of everything, just want to praise the Lord. How unbiblical. The Old Testament said, how come you're asleep? Don't you care if we perish? We're down here getting our backs flayed off. Don't you care? That's biblical worship. Okay, now Vesterman's talking about blessing. And so And I'm just going to kind of leaf through this a little bit, trying to sustain the thesis that Luke's universal concerns grow out of the Old Testament. Tomorrow we're going to talk a little bit more specifically about the poor and the rich. You know, the Old Testament has two minds on what it means to be poor or rich. One of them says, if you're rich, God's blessed you real good. The other one says, the other tradition says, God is the God of the poor. He identifies with poor. If you want to know where God is, he's with poor. How do you get those two together? You got to let the Bible talk to you, both sides of it. Okay, the meaning of this talk about blessing is that one can relate one's whole life in its course from day to day and year to year to God. One receives from God's hand one's whole life, especially in its daily unobtrusiveness, in which nothing particular happens. This is underlined by the fact that blessing and greeting are closely related, and the words blessing and peace are at the same time the words of greeting. The flow of ordinary daily events usually takes place within the family. The two most important forms of community which determine human life, the nation and the family, are different in that in the history of the nation, God's saving and judging are dominant, but in the family, the blessing. Now, Luke, I think, has a lot of stuff about history, about God's redeeming and saving, and also a lot about his blessing. That, I just wanted to share that one in terms of blessing and redeeming, that there's a difference between the two. Then, the promise, and we're going to look at this beginning early tomorrow about this promise of God. The way of promise through the Old Testament is the strongest expression of continuity in the history of the people of God. It holds together large epics. For example, the promises to the patriarchs bind that period with the promise or with the period of the people in Canaan. Both, therefore, have their place, their meaning, and their necessity. God's compassion, which turns toward the suffering creature, and God's compassion on the basis of forgiveness, which heals a broken community. One is God's compassion to the suffering. One is a compassion shown in forgiveness. You read Luke sometime and see how God treats, and Jesus Christ treats the suffering, how he treats broken relationships. I better skip that so we can get it. Then he says, this then is a fundamental proclamation about God common to both the Old and the New Testaments. The proclamation of God as Savior remains the same, even though salvation in the Old and New Testament may mean something different. The message of Christ as Savior rests upon what the Old Testament says about God as Savior. We cannot get along without the Hebrew Bible. When he talks about the cross, when Jesus employs these words, the Psalm of Lament from Psalm 22, when Jesus employs these words on the cross, he enters into the manifold experience of suffering among his people. Thus he is no more than a sufferer among sufferers. Jesus takes up in his lament the same language of pain which was shaped by many individuals in his people over many generations. He not only died for sinners, he died for sufferers as well. Ever think of that? We've been so big on Jesus died for my sins. What about for my pain? Our pain. It says, what we have found in investigating the relationship of the Old Testament to Christ are not relations of contrasts or contrasts of a conceptual type, but rather correspondences or contrasts which relate to a sequence of events, a history of God and humanity. God and humanity. This no longer exists in opposition to others, but for the rest of humanity, as was already said about the servant of the Lord in the servant songs. The saving of the faithful no longer implies death for non-believers. Interesting. Us and them, right? Then he has a statement that I like. The first step toward a fuller biblical understanding, as he's delineated, a first step toward this would be the recognition that what happened is more important than what was thought about it. Okay, we've got all kinds of thinking about things, but what is really important in his mind is what happened. And what part of what Vesterman is arguing for is that we start to again realize that the Bible is story and that we are invited into the biblical story. Now, a couple of things in conclusion. The theological purpose, I believe, for Luke's writing rests in this. What about the promises of God? You know, God is a God of promise. And he went down and he made some big promises to Abraham. Big Daddy Abraham was promised land, nation, and descendants, and that through him would all the nations of the world bless themselves. Then next, God made some promises to David. One of the Davidic kings would always sit with his rear on the throne. What about that promise, particularly following the fall of Jerusalem in 587, when Jerusalem and Israel ain't no more, let alone the king? What about the promises, particularly when the Messiah, the Davidic son, comes, this offspring of Abraham? And the Jews had all kinds of trouble with him, accepting him as the Messiah. I think it's one of the most important New Testament questions. And I believe the New Testament works on that question over time. Paul has his own answer. Some of us will get together a little bit later this week and talk about Paul among Jews and Gentiles, Christer Stendahl's book. And Stendahl agrees with me, so he's right. That the heart of Romans is Romans 9, 10, and 11. When Paul is dealing with what about the rejection by the Jews of Jesus? Does that mean the promises of God are no longer valid? Because if God can make promises to Abraham and to David and to all these folks and they don't come through, then what about the promises he made to us in Jesus Christ? Can they also fall? Boy, that's an important theological question. Paul has a really interesting answer to that. Well, he's just doing this to get us all jealous, and we're now the tree that's been grafted onto the natural olive tree, but boy, the other branches are going to get jealous, and then they're going to jump on, and God's going to save everybody, and that's amen, and that's the way he ends Romans 11, with a big doxology. Luke answers it in a different way. Luke's answer is, the Jews did not reject Jesus. The leaders did, but not the Jewish people. And be very careful with Luke Acts. Luke Acts does not call the church the new Israel. There is only one Israel, the Israel of God. It has its roots in the gracious work of the Creator and the sustaining work of the Redeemer. Read Acts again sometime. Pentecost, how many are saved? How many times do you hear the refrain over and over again? And he added to their number daily those who were being saved, Jew and Greek alike.
Paul waltzes into a synagogue someplace, and what's the first reception? The ordinary folk believe. Then the leaders show up and screw everything up. But always the message is accepted. Last thing I'll say by way of tantalization. Luke does not have a soteriology. For anybody that can bring to us a definitive statement in Luke about how Jesus saves us, I'll take your picture and put it up in my study and remind you that you were the one that showed me that. How did Jesus save us? The forgiveness of sins is to be proclaimed in his name, but Luke never tells us how God pulls that off. That's where I think Vesterman is right about what happened is more important than what was thought about it, and I think Luke is the evidence for that. And so anyway, that's an interesting question. How does Jesus save us in Luke's gospel? Beats me. He came to seek and to save the lost. That's his... That's what he came to do, the how of it. And I think part of the reason that Luke stayed away from that is that we get such crazy theories of the atonement, that God's buying off God, and sometimes the way God comes off in our theories of atonement, who'd want to bother with him? If God is like that and he has to be appeased in that way, you know, that he'd slaughter his own son, which is, you know, there's hints of that, right? That's, you know, I'm not going to say that that's not altogether right, but I'm going to say that Luke wants us to seriously think about that, I think.